Cindy, do you have anything that you'd like to ask
I do.
Tommy? Okay, I do. You jump right in.
I'm wondering this. You say that the Marines changed your life, but I don't know how did they touch you. I don't know what they did. Can you tell me what those things that seemed to impact you so significantly, what are those things that they did?
Are you talking about the Marines that were there in Korea?
Yes.
And I don't know if I want this to go on the radio or not, but when I left Korea, I hated the Marines, despised them, because they were the ones who came into my village. They were the ones that I could hear the laughter when I would try to get in my little house. When I say house, I'm talking about a shack, and I could hear the laughter of my mother and the Marines. But I was locked out during the cold winter nights. A lot of good Marines that were there that helped children, but you had that small percentage that were very abusive to the children. And so therefore, when I left Korea, came to the United States, my attitude toward the military, the Marines, was very negative. And I remember my parents taking us to Disneyland for a summer vacation. And I was walking in front of my parents as I was always. I mean, if you look at the videos, I'm just constantly running back and forth and jumping up and down. And as we were walking in Disneyland, I saw some two or three young Marines that were probably on weekend passes there at Disneyland in their uniform. When I saw them, I ran up behind one of them, kicked him, spit on him, and then ran back to my dad because I knew the fight was going to start. Mm-hmm. And my dad was going to back me up, but we were going to have a fight. And when my father saw what I did and I ran up to him, he picked me up and gave me a swat on my bottom, walked me up to that Marine, and made me apologize for what I had done. And I was brokenhearted that he did not support me against this person that reflected all the negative things in my life. As I grew older and looked back, I realized that really most of those who came were there to help. It was just a small minority that hurt. And I had to forgive those and realize what the mission was. And what they truly gave me was an opportunity for me to be the person that I am today. And so it's not one act of kindness, but it is a country, a nation, who are willing to come and fight for the freedom of the people there, and not to become an empirical nation, part of the United States, but to allow those people then to govern themselves and become a nation among themselves. I look at the countries where the United States have come or have gone and lost our lives, and our men and women are serving those countries. Most of those countries are better off because of the interaction that they have had with the United States of America. And I am thankful to be a part of that country and that cause.
But that is a huge shift to be able to look at it, because you're going from, this is my personal, mm-hmm, to this is a national perspective. How old were you when you got that? Because that's such a mature ability.
Probably in my teens, because living in Junction City and going to church there in Junction City, and my mother, bless her heart, wonderful cook, and our home was always open to the military men who came to our church. And I say men because I don't remember any of the women who came to our church when I was in my high school years there in Junction City.
And Fort Riley was right next to Junction City.
Fort Riley's between Manhattan and Junction City, which is the home of the Big Red One. And so, therefore, my mother would cook all Saturday. And Sunday, if the military people that were there did not have a place to go, they were invited to our home to have church dinner or Sunday dinner. And she would have at least 2 to 3 meats, have at least 6 to 7 pies, and she was a great pie maker. And so, therefore, I had military men in my home at least once a week. And not only would they come for lunch, but then they would just take naps laying on the floor in the living room or watch TV, watch ball games or whatever. And so I saw that perspective, that aspect of the lives of the military men. And I think it opened my heart as I got to know these men. And then that gave a different reflection to my first 7 years therein in Korea.
There was some divine intervention going on.
I truly believe in that.
Yeah.
Yes.
When your life is over, how do you want to be remembered?
That I fought a good fight. That I cared.
He's a remarkable man.
I told you before we started that he would be a remarkable story. And,
wow.
You know, that's why I wanted you here, because you are a remarkable story. I respect you.
Thank you.
I admire you. But also in the fact that we are fellow Marines, I appreciate that. And you are what I think a veteran is, what I would like to think all veterans are. And I believe that they are. I think all veterans really and truly feel, and maybe all is a wrong word, but I think the veterans in this country feel like they did a service.
Yes.
And they're proud of what they have done, and they would do it again all over.
Yes.
Whatever war it is, even today in Desert Storm and Pakistan and Afghanistan, all those places, they would go do it again if they felt their country called them to do it. And to me, that's what the veteran is. He went and served the country because the country called him to do it, and he was dedicated, committed to his country. And that's what I see you as. No one could ever say you didn't fight a good fight and that you didn't care.
But. Thank you. One of the, you know, you talk about the hand of God and intervention. A story that I've never shared when I've been speaking is that back then, even today, when people adopt children from overseas, it's about a 2-year process. Roy and Ruth had put in their application to adopt a child in November of 1958. The month that I went to the Holt Orphanage is when they sent in their application to adopt a child, expecting it to be 2 years. A family from New Mexico had applied 2 years previous. A week before I was to come over to the United States. But this family had gotten my adoption papers. They were my adoptive parents. A week before I was supposed to come to the United States, they contacted the Holt Orphanage and said, "We don't want this child." So the Holt Orphanage had this little boy that had all the paperwork, had gotten the paperwork to come to the United States, and no family to take him. So they called the Webb family 3 days prior to my flight time, and the Webb said, "Yes, will take this little boy. So I truly believe that everything really is in the hands of God. Because I don't know if the family in New Mexico could have handled this little boy, the street child, as well as the Webbs did. My parents were very open with me and explained everything to me. And one of the questions that I asked my mother was, why'd they wait 2 years? And then they said no. And my mother said, well, maybe they had a child. Maybe one of them became ill. And there's a lot of different scenarios that we discussed. When I became an adult, I thought, I would like to find out, because this family really had an important role of getting me here to the United States, and I would like to visit with them, say thank you. And so in early 1990s, I researched and found out where this family lived, and they had moved from New Mexico to California. And I called them one day, and a man answered the phone, and I explained to him who I was, and he said, oh, I'm so glad you called. He said, we have wondered all these years what happened to you. And so we visited, and his wife had been deceased, and he had remarried, and they'd adopted a little boy from New Mexico through the services there, adoption services in New Mexico. And we visited for 15 and 20 minutes. And finally, when we came to the conclusion of our visit, I said, there's one question that I've always wondered. So I asked him, you guys waited 2 years. And then a week before I came, you said no. Why? To which his response was, they sent us your picture. And I was taken a little back, and I said, well, I wasn't that ugly. He said, no. He said, no. It had nothing to do with how you looked. It dealt with your age. My wife and I were unable to have children, and we wanted a child that was 7 or 8 months old, not 7 or 8 years old, who was already half grown. And so there was a miscommunication, and when they sent us the paperwork for us to sign the final papers and your picture, we said, oh my, this is not what we asked for. And so that is why we contacted the Holt and said, no, we do not want a child that's 7 or 8 years of age. And I said, well, I understand, and thank you, and thank you for being a part of the process, because you guys played an important part. And there again, I think it's the hand of God.
Yes.
His intervention, yes.
One of the things my son-in-law struggles with, and he's going to be doing his third tour in the Middle East this fall, is that children are even the enemy now. I mean, and that is a hard struggle. And I'm wondering how, when you talk to active duty, I mean, how are you supposed to deal with that? That even seeing children, we hear your story, and I hear your story, and then I hear Nate's stories about children, and I think, how do I reconcile those two, and how would I even deal with that?
And children have been, even during the Vietnam War, we had children that were utilized. We had children, I mean, World War II, you go back in history, and today, in the Middle East, children are being utilized. South America, children are being utilized. No matter what kind of war you're fighting, was war on drugs or war on terrorism, whatever the case might be. So our military men and women need to understand who their potential enemies are and be trained to protect themselves and others. But my story to them is this: value yourself and understand that you are making a difference in the lives that you are touching as you go to these different nations. I spoke at a teacher in service, and I can't remember whether it was in Chapman High School or whether it was in Larned. It was one of those teacher and services. But after I finished speaking, one of the ladies came up to me and she said, I had a cousin that lost her father during the Korean War. And when he was killed, I remember the nights that we hugged each other and wept. And the question that she would ask me was, why? Why did this happen? And this teacher said to me, she said, all these years, my response has been, I don't know. I don't know. She said, I'm going to go home today, and I'm going to call my cousin and tell her, I know why. I know why. He made a difference in the life of this child. And that child came and spoke today and touched our hearts. That's the message that I want to give to those men and women who are serving our country. You have value. And we value others. That is why we are there serving. A soldier does not fight because not our soldiers, not American soldiers. We do not fight because we hate those that are in front of us. We fight because we love those who are behind us. And that's what makes us different as Americans, as we take up our arms and we fight to protect those whom we love.
And so that's how you reconcile your ministry with being a soldier, isn't it?
Yes.
Because at first, when I heard you saying those things, I'm thinking, aren't those things in direct conflict with each other?
No. You serve because you love. And love comes from God.
I think part of it goes back, too, to what you were saying. We don't go to war to become an imperialistic country.
No.
We go to war to free those people. That's what we're trying to do in the Middle East. We're trying to free those people so they can have a life of freedom like our patriots fought for in the Revolutionary War. And they can have a life of freedom to form their own government, to form their own destiny, to realize their own future.
Yes.
A future of freedom, not being controlled or dictated to or manipulated, whatever. That's why, whether you think Vietnam was right or wrong, and there's people that will debate that all day long with you, in my mind, we were there because we were trying to give those people the opportunity to have a free life and establish their own government that would give them a free life and not have to be enslaved.
That's right. That's right.
So,
one of different groups I speak to, I my life story, I share that. But then if they, like teacher and services, I'll speak for like 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I've done West Star Leadership, which I do 3 hours. And national conferences, keynote, I usually do 1 hour, which is my life story. But one of the stories that I'm going to start implementing is about the silent leaders among us. Those that do not get on stage and speak, those that are not recognized by certificates or leadership or plaques of gratitude or whatever else that is given to them. But I truly believe it is because of the silent leaders that our communities are what they are. And the story that I share, I'm going to start sharing in that venue, is in January, I was asked to speak at the Chamber Banquet in Winfield, Kansas, and my wife and I went there. So Friday night. We left Saturday morning, and because my wife had a 30% Kohl discount to discount at Kohl store, we had to go to that store so she could look and shop and get her 30% discount. But on the way to Kohl's, she asked if we could stop at this store, just run in and look. And I said, of course. So we parked and we went in and spent a little bit of time. And then as we were walking out, there right down the same shopping area was a Target store. And she said, I really need to get this. Do you mind if I just walk down there and you just drive around the parking lot and just pick, you don't have to come in. You just take me a second. I said, okay. So she went to Target. I went out to get the car and I drove around the parking lot of Target about three times. The third time I came around, she was standing there, picked her up, and I went, started outside going out of the parking lot, the same route that I had taken three times previously. And halfway out of the parking lot, Judy said to me, stop, stop. And I, we're in the parking lot. And then she said, stop, Tommy. And so I came to a stop. And she opened the door, jumped out, and she grabbed these two purses. Now, when I say purses, I'm talking about large. One was a billfold size, but the other one was a little bit bigger than a billfold, about 12 inches across and 5 or 6 inches wide. And beautiful, beautiful person. And she closed the door and she opened up the purse, the large purse, and inside of it were $100 bills. And in the smaller one was a white envelope with a name written on it. And inside of that was $20 bills. And she counted all the monies, and there was $800 in those two little billfolds. She looked at me and she said, Tom, what should I do? I said, well, is there any identification? She said, this is all that's in here, is this white envelope and this cash money. I said, well, why don't we go back and you run into Target and just let them know that you found something in the parking lot. And if someone can identify, they lost something out in your parking lot, and they can identify what it is they lost, here's my phone number, call me. And so Judy ran into Target, and I'm sitting there in the car, and my heart just breaks as I'm thinking, if this happened to one of my children, mm-hmm. this would be devastating. I mean, this could pay their monthly bills or this, you know? And I'm thinking, oh, someone please come and inquire about the monies and the purse. And Judy came back in the car, and we left and we went to Kohl's. We got home and she went to work. And every night we visited, because she goes to Guymon, Oklahoma for 3 days. She's a respiratory therapist, and she stays there for 3 days and then comes home after the third day. Every night we were visiting, she, has anyone called? I said, no, Judy, no one's called. Wednesday night she got home and she says, no one's called? I said, no, honey, no one's called. Thursday morning we get up and she said, I'm going to contact the purse company. I said, what do you mean? She said, there's a name inside the purse, and it was called Cahoots. She said, I saw this advertised in a magazine a few years ago. I'm going to call them and see if they have a distributor in Wichita, Kansas. And so Thursday, she got on the phone and called. The phone rang and rang and rang. No one answered. So Friday, we get up. She goes, you know, I'm going to try one more time. And so she got back on internet and got the number. And it was 9:30 in the morning. She called, and a lady picked up the phone. And the lady, I think her name is Patty. And she said, Patty, do you have any stores here in Wichita that sell your product? And the lady said, ma'am, we don't. This company was started by a friend and myself about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, and we make all of our products here. We made over a million here, but we don't have anyone else that distributes. It's all through our store here in Gainesville, Texas. That was where the store was. And Judy said, well, thank you, and then hung up. And I said, well, Judy, I said, I think you've done all that you can do. Let's just wait a little bit longer, and maybe someone from Wichita will call us or Target will call us. Saturday morning, we got up, and Judy said, it's like a voice in her head that said, you haven't done everything that you can do. And so she thought, well, what else can I do? And so we visited a little bit, and she said, you know, I'm going to call this company back and just describe this purse to the person, because it's a very unique purse. It's made out of fabric and beautiful pheasant on it, and maybe they know, if they make all of them there, maybe they know. I said, honey, a million, I mean, come on. She goes, I'm gonna try. Okay. And so she called, and about 9:30 Saturday morning, and the lady answered the phone, and Judy said, this is a very particular, this is a unique call that I'm making to you, and I hope you can help me. And the lady goes, well, I like unique calls. Go ahead, hit me what you've got. So Judy explained to her the purse that we had found in Wichita. And when she described the purse to this lady, the lady said, you know what? I'm going to go on her Facebook page and describe it. And if you'll give me your phone number, I bet you'll get a call today. And Judy goes, well, that'd be wonderful. And hung up. And 15 minutes later, the phone rang. I looked at Judy and I said, there's your call. And she goes, oh, no. She picked up the phone, and little gal goes, is this Judy Webb? And Judy said, yes, ma'am. She goes, I'm so-and-so from Gainesville, Texas. And I think you found something that belongs to me. And Judy said, would you describe it to me? And the little gal described it to her and what the other purse looked like. And her name was Caitlin. And she said, Caitlin, can you describe to me what was in this purse? And she said, you know, I don't know exactly how much, but she goes, probably around $800 or $900 was in that purse. I know it was less than $1,000 that was in there. Judy said, well, there was a white envelope with a name on it. How do you spell your name? And the little girl goes, oh, I go by Katie, but I spell it. And she explained to her how she spelled her name. That was exactly how it was on that little white envelope. And Judy said, yes, I do have something that belongs to you. And a little girl said to her, oh, you don't know how this makes my day. She said, when I grew up, that fabric was from a couch that was in my home. And my parents had that made for me from that fabric. And she said, I was about to call my mother today to let her know that I had lost that purse. And she said, but you called. And she said, the other thing is, today's my birthday. This is the best birthday present that anyone could have given to me. She goes, thank you. She goes, can I come and pick it up? And Judy goes, well, we live in Sublette, about 200 miles away. But she said, I'd be more than willing to send it her. And she said, you know, my boyfriend works at Wichita State University. She attends OU in Norman. Her boyfriend just graduated last year, is a professor at Wichita State University. And that's where the connection was to Wichita. And so we were going through Wichita the next week. And so Judy ran the purse and the money up to this little gal's boyfriend. But you know, Judy reflects that silent leadership that's within our communities that make our communities a place that people want to be a part of. The next week we were at Topeka having dinner with my daughter and grandchildren, and Judy was so proud that I'm receiving a leadership thing from Kansas State University, one of the schools there. And she was telling our two grandsons, 10 and 11 about how proud she was that I was receiving this honor. And as she was sharing that story, after she finished, I said, Judy, share with them about what happened in Wichita and the purse. And so she shared that story with our grandchildren and our daughter. And after dinner, one of my grandsons went up to her and gave her a big hug and looked up at her and said, Gigi, I am so proud of you. And I observed that. And I thought, you know what? It doesn't matter how many awards I get or recognitions I get. It is things like this that people do within our communities that truly reflect character and integrity and truly is the role model for our children and grandchildren and our neighbors and our friends. They are truly the silent leaders within our communities. And I'm blessed to know many of those people and call many of them my friends.
Now, what about bullying? Because here you are, a little guy, growing up. Did people pick on you?
Oh. In the Korean culture, you are either pure Korean or you're not Korean at all.
Okay.
And because I'm mixed, and I have no idea what my nationality is on my father's side. I know my mother's full-blooded Korean, but my father, I have no idea. But since I was not pure Korean, I was rejected by the other children.
Now, how did they know?
When you look at me, you know that I'm not full Korean.
So just by appearance?
Just by. And there are other kids in that village, the street kids. They were in the same. So those were the kids who hung together. But we hung together for safety reasons also, because people would pick on us or kids would beat us. Korean people would beat us because we were outcasts, rejects. And so therefore I grew up fighting. That's how I survived, was you either fought or you ran. And when I came to the United States, I had a lot of scars on my face because of the fights and abuses that occurred. And I don't know where I was going. What? Oh, the bullying aspect of it.
Yeah.
I grew up fast, and I became one of the biggest kids. When I was in junior high in the eighth grade, I was already 5'9", and probably weighed 150, 160 pounds. So, you know, I played fullback on our junior high football team. I was a linebacker. I played center on our basketball team because I was the big kid. But so I wasn't bullied, but I would not allow other people to bully. I would step in.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a few weeks ago, I spoke at the chamber banquet in Junction City, and the chamber president, I had never met him. And when Judy and I went to the auditorium where we were having our banquet that night, he introduced himself and he said, I got a call from Alan so-and-so. He's in Florida and he just wanted you to know that he's sorry that he could not be here tonight. And I said, well, I'm sorry I missed Alan, but I'm glad he's able to be in Florida for the winter. And, you know, and then the president of the Junction City Chamber said, and he told me about some of the fights that you were in when you were in school. And most of those fights were because you were defending the kids that are being bullied. And you would step in and stand up for those kids that were less fortunate. I said, yes, I've had a few fights. And I wish Alan hadn't shared those with you, but I'm thankful that my friends remember me in school, as the one who stood up.
Yes.
For those, because that's something that I would not allow. I remember one kid in music, he was probably 20-some years old and probably had the IQ level, probably 7th or 8th year old child, even if that. But he was in gym class and he was in music class. Those were two that he would walk to school, and when he sang, he would rock back and forth. And I remember one day a new kid was in class, and he made fun of this kid because he was rocking, and he was about halfway through what he was saying, and I said, stop. Don't ever say that about this individual, at least when I'm around, or there's consequences to pay. He might not be able to defend himself, but as long as I'm around, I'll defend him.
So maybe we need more of that now. Would you say, I don't know, how are you going to teach young people to deal with bullying?
I don't think fighting is the answer, but I don't think walking away or running away from the situation is the answer. I think we need to teach our young people how to stand up for that which is right and not to be ashamed of that. And devaluing others because they do not meet a certain standard that we have set within our minds, or our little group has set, that isn't right. When I speak to high schools, I tell them, every person has value. Every person is special. And we don't have the right to devalue others. We don't have that right. Our town has put in a bid for beautify the community. There's some federal funding out there. So the mayor came to me and said, the engineers from KDOT are going to be here at 2:00 Monday. Can you be here representing our community? And we're going to have different people to meet with them. And I said, well, I'm in court in Liberal, but if I can get away soon enough, I'll be up here. And I was able to do that. And I said, and I've got a meeting that evening back in Liberal, but I said, if I can do it, and sure enough, I had the times that I was able to come back to Sublette, and I was in a meeting, and the two engineers came and sat and were visiting, and one of the engineers looked at me and said, do you speak? He said, do you do any motivational speaking? I said, yes, sir, I do, and yes, I've spoken to KDOT, to your state conference, twice. He said, I knew I'd seen you somewhere. He said, you were in Kansas City, spoke at our conference, and he said to me, I'll never forget what you shared with us. And then the other engineer said, I'll never forget the message that you shared with us. And then after the meeting, as we were shaking hands, the first one who had said something said to me, every night, I tell my kids, you're special. So I want you to know that I am following up with what you challenged us with. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we are making a difference in the lives that we touch. Yeah.
But just your willingness to stand up and not let somebody be bullied, to me, is the whole thing within our military.
Yes.
We're willing to go and help someone less fortunate. Yes. Because they are less fortunate. Mm-hmm. And they can't defend themselves.
You're right. 25 years as a judge, I have never yelled or cursed at any of the litigants, attorneys. If you had asked my clerks, has Judge Webb ever yelled at you, they would say, no, no. I see myself as a judge to help people, not to hurt people. And when people come to my court, I don't care what the allegations are, I will always show respect to that individual. I might not condone what they've been charged with or what they found guilty with, but I do not have the right to devalue that person as a human being. I don't have that right. And so therefore, whoever comes in my court will be shown respect. But in return, I expect that respect for the court and for the judiciary. It's not about me. It is about the judge, that position, and what that is reflected within our society.
Who taught you that? How did you learn that? About devaluing and respect. Did that come from your parents?
I don't know if something that my parents sat down and said, here's what I want you to learn. But I think it is the years of watching them model integrity, character, watching those that they associate with, their role models within my life. Comparing that to the role models within my first 7 years of life, 8 years of life, and what kind of person do I want to be?
So did you realize you had a conscious choice? Because when you're doing that, that's what I'm
hearing. That process probably started as a teenager, and it has sort of been in that process. It is not where you just come to a definitive here, but it is still a process, just like watching Judy and interaction with our grandchildren saying, that's what life is all about. When we went to Kohl's, I went in with her because I knew it wouldn't be a few minutes. And when we checked out, she had a big bag that was full. And the lady who checked us out, I don't know what faith she was, but she had the head wrap and the long garb of the Middle East people. And as we were walking out of Kohl's, we stopped at the street to go to the parking lot. And Judy said to me, she said, something's just not right. I said, what do you mean? She goes, I don't know. But she goes, something's just not right. So she opened up her bag, took out the receipt, and looked at the receipt. She goes, she did not charge me for that dress. She turned around, and I followed her. She went back into the store. And as we walked into the store, the lady who had checked us out, there's no one in front of her. So Judy went back to that lady and said to the lady, ma'am, one of the dresses you forgot to charge me for. And the lady looked at Judy and said, thank you for coming back. Now in that Kohl's, she was facing us, and there was another clerk that was facing the other direction at another checkout. And then there was a third lady facing the same direction as our cashier. And the young lady that was facing the other direction had turned around because she saw Judy walk in with that bag. And when the conversation occurred, the young lady, probably in her early 20s, said to my wife, you came back? And Judy smiled and said, yes. And then the young lady looked at my wife and said, you came back. Totally different tone of like, you came back. And then a woman came to check out, and so she turned around to take care of her customer. And I stood there, watched that, and thought, what was going through her mind and her heart? But she just became a model of integrity and of character. Not to the lady that checked you out, maybe there also, but definitely to this young lady whose first attitude was, you came back.
And I'd have taken the dress.
Yeah. All of a sudden, you came back.
But you know, yeah. Tommy, there's a whole nother story here to answer part of her question about where you learned, how you came about to have just as an instinct to make people feel special. And I don't think we have time today, but the story of your mother.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I know that that's where you got a lot of that instilled in you, not by word, not by saying, here's what you need to do, but by observation and watching.
Oh, you bet.
Your mother. Mm-hmm. As she handled the children that she taught and as she cared for those children. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I don't, that's another story that is probably too long for us to get into today, but I would like some time for Cindy to be able to hear that story. Maybe it might be on your CD. I don't know, or your, but your mother was a very, not a big woman, a very, a tiny woman, and loved the people she taught, lived with, the children that she, and they loved her.
Yes, yes, they were truly her children.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, just for a person to open up their home to cook that much food and open up her home to strangers because she saw them as men who served our country, and this is her way of serving and saying thank you to them.
And having stuff for the children at school in the mornings because they didn't have anything to eat.
Yes. Yeah.
That's where a lot of that came from.
Oh, I think in part we are a product of our society and our culture. And that's why I think it is so important that we as adults conduct ourselves in a way that would be good for others to follow, especially our younger children. Yeah.
To be an example.
To be an example, yeah. Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Really?
Well, I don't want to end this, but we need to for right now, I think.
I think so, probably.
Go get us something to eat and